Welcome back to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. We've heard over and over that tech is getting better at anticipating our every need, knowing when we are going to run out of toilet paper or when we want to see ads for cars. But what if devices could anticipate more than just material needs? They could tell if we were feeling needy or totally exhilarated. Rosalyn Picard has made this her project, and her creations are on the cusp of affecting our daily lives in a big way. She's a professor at MIT. She's founded the companies Affectiva and Empatica. Rosalyn, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've been working on tech that's smarter and more sensitive than we've ever seen. How do you put more emotion into the computing world?
It's not about making computers more emotional. You know, I don't want my laptop to start acting snide, you know, or stressed, right? What we want is it to be more tuned in to what is going on with us right. in a way that makes it more emotionally intelligent. Most technology is mood blind right now. If you're in the middle of concentrating, working hard on a deadline, it's going to be really stupid about popping up with, you know, time to update your computer, right? You know, something it thinks is important that's clearly not important to you right then. If it instead knew what mattered to you, that you're focused and this focus time has a critical deadline associated with it, then it would respect that and it would hold back, you know, anything that wasn't critical.
Okay, and let's say then that your laptop or your phone or whatever knows that you're pressed for time and sees your eyebrows are raised or knows that you're surprised or whatever. What do you do with that information?
If you're creating a video that you're putting online and you're going to spend a lot of time and money to make it right, and people are willing to opt in and turn on their camera so you can watch them watching it, it's important to you to see, as you're editing the video, which parts are engaging them and which parts are where they're disconnecting and no longer showing any signs of interest or engagement.
Okay, and are makers of videos doing that now? Are they engaging
they
in
are. You can imagine
at whether our eyebrows go up?
They absolutely are. The first company I co-founded, Affectiva, is running 24/7 now in over 65 countries, measuring people who opt in to have the camera look at them while they look at content. And right now, the content is mostly by advertisers or people making movie trailers or people making educational online content.
Let me bring up an ethical issue. If we know that people respond a certain way to a Pepsi commercial or a Coke commercial, and more importantly, Pepsi knows that, so they know how to make something that's going to tug at your heartstrings or keep you interested or make you really, really excited about getting a Pepsi, aren't we talking about manipulation sort of on a scale we've never seen because they can really fine-tune this to exactly what we want, exactly what will press our buttons?
There is definitely interest in selling us products and understanding what gives the emotional experience that connects to that drive to like that brand or to want to engage more with that product. This is not new to affective technology. It has been around from the beginning. The affective technology, we can look at it as manipulation when it's selling. We can also look at it as giving the consumer a voice, a nonverbal voice. Finally, we have the ability to simply scowl or smirk at something that we don't like and let the makers of that content know that we don't like it. And this is the flip side of it that maybe the advertisers weren't quite expecting, is that we're also showing them that a lot of times they're spending money on things that people don't like, that they don't want to see. And now the power is back with us who are willing to opt in and show that we don't like that.
And you mentioned educational content. Give me an example of where this sort of sense of how you're responding to a video, how would that actually be used?
Yeah, in education, well, I'll just say as a teacher, it's been very humbling when I see the affective responses of my students.
Do you do this with
your
students?
Oh, yeah, I do this.
Oh, no,
for example,
and then you take it home and you have to say that line, and
well,
that line's coming out of the talk because it's too boring.
Yeah, exactly. I would see it live. I would see that I thought you know, I'd say, how are you doing? And how clear is this? And everybody would show a blank face, like they perfectly understood it. And then I'd write the mathematical equations on the board, and there would be all this furrowing of the brow, you know, especially when my back was to the class. But I measured the furrowing, and I saw, oh, they're actually really showing a lot of concentration and confusion, you know, more than showing that they're really understanding it. We've also done it with our wearable sensors that measure your autonomic activation that goes up when you're engaged or excited or stressed. And I'll see it go up when there's a new topic being introduced or we're cracking a joke or there's a live demonstration. It always goes up. And one of the humbling things for we MIT faculty is in most classroom engagement, especially PowerPoint, it just goes flat.
Can you imagine that spreading out? Have other teachers said to you, hey, I want to check how kids are responding to my lectures? Or do they say, like, keep that as far away from
you,
me
you
as
see
possible?
Both. We see teachers who don't want any measurement. You know, they are very threatened by the fact that somebody might objectively see that they're just not engaging the class. We also see people who use it to improve their style of interaction with the class, and it's fabulous.
Give me a sense. There's other uses, too, of this sort of picking up on what the body is doing by sensors and by technology. I know there's medical uses.
Yes.
Give me a sense of what some of those are right now, and then maybe going forward what they could be.
One of the big surprises we had was while one of my students borrowed a sensor to measure his little brother who has autism and was non-speaking, and he wanted to read out his stress. And while the boy was wearing the sensor, we saw typical stress changes in the signal, but one gargantuan peak. And I thought the sensor was broken, honestly. And after debugging it, we learned that the peak was not the sensor broken. It was due to excessive brain activity associated with a seizure. So now we're in lots of hospitals, and I've started another company, Empatica, that is coming out with a product called Embrace that will be consumer-facing, and it will allow people to detect their seizures and also track sleep and stress that may help them understand what gives rise to their seizures.
Now, when you push this out a little bit and think, okay, well, this is what we can do now, but in 10, 15, 20 years, what do you think the medical applications could be for technology that really does know when we're stressed, that knows when we're happy, that knows when we're very angry, whatever?
I'm excited. I think the wearable technology is going to bring about a complete revolution in health. And we will look back on it and say, how did we ever, you know, take care of ourselves without this information? Think of it like weather forecasting, you know, 150 years ago. It was completely inaccurate, right? People
right.
are making wild guesses. A lot of health is like that too. You're sort of making a wild guess. Am I getting sick or not? I can't tell if I'm just tired or I'm coming down with something. But with the wearable technology, we can read out changes in our body. And I think it's going to be much more like accurate weather forecasting in the future. We're going to be able to see that, you know, if this person keeps up this pattern of not enough sleep and this much stress and not enough physical activity and this little social interaction, they may be on a downslide to depression or even a serious mental health disorder.
That's fascinating to me. So you think we may be in a situation, if you're comparing it to weather forecasting, that we might say, in 24, 48 hours, I think I'm going to have the flu.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't have it right
exactly.
now, but I will.
Exactly. And even cooler than weather forecasting, you know, we can forecast 80% chance of rain, take an umbrella, but we can't change the rain. Right. With the health forecast, we actually have the opportunity to change what the outcome is. So we can say you have a 80% likelihood of coming down with the flu, but you can reduce that to 40% if you get a couple extra hours of sleep.
Is there a danger in all of this of computers, once computers can pick up on emotions, of them just knowing a lot about you? So, for example, maybe I just want to be sad without having a digital record of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe
yeah.
I have even opted in, but I didn't realize that somewhere out there encoded in bits is the fact that, like, I got really sad that day and I don't want people to know about it.
Yeah. When I started the area of affective computing, the number one interest is showing respect for people's feelings. And if your feelings include, I don't want people to know my feelings, which they do sometimes, mm-hmm. then the technology needs to show respect for that too. So our focus has really been on putting you in control of what it can and can't do and enabling the information to give you insights that help you live your life better. It's not about giving it to other people or your boss or things that you don't want. In all of our cases, it's about showing respect for the user's feelings or the wearer's feelings.
When we talk about something, we've been talking about medical uses, but when we look at something that's sort of more everyday, like, for example, let's say you're wearing something that knows that you're stressed. Mm-hmm. What can any gadget do about that? How does it help for them to pick up on the fact that you're stressed? A seizure is one thing, clearly, you need medical attention. Yeah. But
for example, it's been shown that when people's car navigation systems talk to them, that if the voice sounds really cheery and happy and the driver is cheery and happy, the driver drives better. If the driver, however, is kind of sad, then if the voice sounds cheery and happy, the driver drives worse.
Wow.
If, however, the voice is subdued when the driver is sad, the driver makes fewer errors, can focus more. So we know that intelligent systems will adapt their affect to you. If you're stressed, they will respond differently to you so that it helps reduce your stress.
Does that at all put somebody in danger of never having to adapt? So if you're in a class, for example, and the teacher is getting a read on how people are doing in the class, you know, if they're stressed or whatever, maybe they tailor what they're saying and try to make it a little less stressful somehow, or with their work a little less complicated. Isn't it good, though, sometimes to challenge people, to put them in stressful situations,
to make them
have to deal with things, even though, like, at that moment, that's not what they would choose to be doing?
Absolutely. And I've just come from meetings with experts on stress and sleep and performance, and a lot of them are working with the military. And if you know that you're training people for a high-stress situation, then the training does need to include pushing them to places where nobody wants to go naturally. Because only by being in those situations do you start to understand what to expect from yourself, how to help yourself through it, how to manage other teammates who are going through it. And as unpleasant as it is, you emerge from it better equipped to deal with a real-world crisis.
Rosalind Picard is a professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT. She's helped found a number of companies, including Affectiva. Rosalind, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.